Good morning, and welcome to the beginning of the Navi part of Tanakh in a Day. Navi will take a considerably longer time than the Tough of Tanakh took. We did grant Chumash a full hour. I thought that was generous of us. But we have Yehoshua, and then followed by Shoftim. There are associates in the back. It looks like people saw them. Thank you very much. I want to thank our sponsors for this half hour, Tzipora and Tommy Zwiebel, in loving memory of Alfred Ellenbogen and George Zwiebel, Zichronam Levracha. I'll also note, for the benefit of those here as well as those watching at home, that you can go to www.torontotorah.com/Tanakh in order to get the roster for the full day of Shiurim, as well as to donate for the in honor of the program as well. So Yehoshua is our topic for the next 27 minutes. It is obviously the first book in Navi, in the prophets, but more than that, it's the only book in Nevi'im and Ksuvim, Nevi'im and Ktuvim, depending on how you want to pronounce it. It is the only book which the Gemara thinks was truly necessary out of all of Nevi'im and Ktuvim, all of the prophets and the writings. If you take a look at source number one on your sheet, the Gemara in Nedarim, I'm going to use the English, but I brought the Hebrew so that those who want to read that are able to see it. Rabbi Chanina said, had Israel not sinned, meaning with the Egel, the golden calf, they would have been given only the five Chumashim, as well as the book of Yehoshua, for it speaks of the value of the land of Israel. If not for the Egel, that would have been it. Tanakh would have been a lot shorter. Tanakh in a day could have been Tanakh in an hour, and an hour and change, and that would have been that. But the Egel changes things. And what I want to highlight is not so much the Egel, the golden calf, that's an interesting shear for another time, but the fact that the Gemara views the primary value of the book of Yehoshua as introducing us to the value of the land of Israel. And what I want to contend for the next half hour, I hope to show, is that what this means is not Yehoshua shows us the value of a piece of real estate. Rather, it's about the transition that we make when we go from Egypt to Israel, the effect that that land has on us as a nation, on our identity, as I put in the title of the shiur, from slaves to Israelis. The change in our identity, where we go from being these slaves who got out of Mitzrayim, who got out of Egypt, to becoming citizens of our own land. But first, I want to talk about the book itself. I want to talk about the book of Yehoshua. So, I apologize in advance, but this is going to be rapid, and I'm not really going to be able to take questions for the most part, because it's half an hour on a book that covers 28 years. The book of Yehoshua describes the events of the first 28 years of the Jews in Israel. There are references in the book to battles that are fought afterwards, but primarily it's focused on those 28 years. The book focuses on the following themes. The first steps of the Jewish nation in their own land. The story of the Jewish people is no longer being told based on a single figure, an Avraham, a Yosef, a Moshe, but instead it's based on the experiences of the nation as a whole with multiple plot lines going on within the nation. It is our first extended look at the land of Israel itself. We had a little bit in Avraham's day, and then you don't really see it until now. You see, as another theme, the fulfillment of divine commands by the nation and by Yehoshua. You see the consequences of violating those commands. When a gentleman named Achan takes from the spoils from the war with Jericho, the spoils have been prohibited, and the nation as a whole suffers as a consequence. We see conquest. We see the question of ethnic cleansing, which really is its own discussion that has to really be addressed. The issue of, it won't be in this half hour, but it has to be addressed in general, the question of what it means to come into a land and eradicate the societies that you find there. The challenges that face the Jews. How do the Jewish people move on after Moshe? How can anyone take his place? The struggle of applying the central authority that you had in the Midbar, in the wilderness, to a diffuse population living all over a new land. The challenge of retaining our identity when we enter Canaanite society. These are the critical questions that we face in Yehoshua. And really, I regret the fact that I learned it in grade 4. Because in grade 4, you're not alert to any of this. You know, it's really something that requires revisiting with an adult mind to really grasp the challenges that we're talking about. The book is almost entirely written in prose, except for one shira, one poem that appears in the 10th parak, and the list of the kings who they defeated. The Gemara in Bava Basra tells us that Yoshua wrote it. If you take a look at source number 2 on your sheet, the Gemara says Yoshua wrote his book. And then it challenges and says, well, wait a minute. How can you say Yoshua wrote his book? The Pasuk says, and Yoshua ben Nun, servant of God, died. We're told at the end of the book that Yoshua passes away. So the answer is yes, Eleazar son of Aaron concludes the book of Yoshua. To which the Gemara says, but the book records that Eleazar son of Aaron died. How can he have authored it? Yeah, Pinchas picked up there. So as the author passed away, the next author picked up and covered the rest of the book. Nonetheless, as I noted before, there are events that are post-Yoshua that make it into the book. So I noted you a comment from Rashi in source number 3. In chapter 19 of the book, we're told that the Jews, that specifically the tribe of Dan, fought a war with a city called Leshem. They conquer a new area. Dan originally settles in the southwestern part of Israel, and then they grab an area way northeast on the other side of the Jordan, on the other side of the Yarden. But that doesn't happen until the period of the Shoftim. As Rashi notes, this actually occurs later in the time of Othniel ben Kenaz and Micha's idol, as recorded in Shoftim. So there are events that take place later that are still back recorded in the book, so much so that Don Isaac of Barbanel in source number 4 said that despite the fact that the Gemara says Yoshua wrote it, he says, I don't think so. He says the text testifies and informs that Yoshua didn't write it. When you're a Barbanel, you say things like that. Normally you don't get to say things like that, but a Barbanel does and he gets away with it. But he believes that it's collected from segments written by Yehoshua. Certainly the key figure in the book is Yehoshua himself, even though it's about the nation. And there's a lot to be said about Yehoshua personally. Yehoshua has been in training with Moshe for 40 years. Right? When did Yehoshua first appear in the Chumash? Amalek, right. The war with Amalek at the end of Bashalach, long before there are spies. Not that long before, fine. But before the Torah is given. Yoshua shows up as a general in the war with Amalek. He is the second in command to Moshe. When Moshe goes up Har Sinai, he leaves, he has Yoshua partway up the mountain. He does, of course, become a spy in that ill-fated mission. Yoshua is a scholar. He's the student of Moshe who never leaves the tent. He's filled with wisdom. He is a Navi. He's a prophet. Ish asher ruach bo. He has the Spirit of God within him. Hashem speaks to him directly. He is a king. There's a death penalty in the first chapter of Yehoshua for people who disobey Yehoshua's orders. He's a military strategist, not only as a general against Amalek, but when they enter the land, he's the one who dictates the order of the wars that they're going to fight. The Dat Mikra edition of Yehoshua shows you how the wars they fight are actually a very neat arc. They work their way around Yerushalayim as they come in. I'm working from my right to left, but you can reverse it. It's like a menorah. They enter the land and they fight wars that cover an arc heading west toward the Mediterranean around the north side of Yerushalayim, and then they come around and they circle it to go around the south of Yerushalayim. It's a brilliant move because now that central area is taken, and then you have the ability, now that you've cut off everything in the middle, you have the ability, theoretically at any rate, to conquer what's in the middle. I say theoretically because we know that they didn't conquer everything that they were supposed to. But that's the way the Dan Mikra paints his conquest. It's fascinating. He's a sensitive leader. His own Shevet, his own tribe, comes to him complaining that they don't have enough land, and he says to them, conquer what you've been given. Because he's concerned about the possibility of the appearance of favoritism if he were to try to give them something more. He governs with the aid of elders. He doesn't do it unilaterally. But he's not afraid to buck the trends, like in the story with the Meraglim, with the spies. He's our most successful leader. The most successful leader in Jewish history is Yehoshua. Because for 28 years, as the text testifies and as the Gemara comments, the Jews don't worship idols. They don't go off and do things that they're not supposed to do. That's it. We got 28 years under Yehoshua in which we did what we were supposed to do. Unfortunately, the seeds of future failure start with some of the problems in his day. But really, he's a success, which is great because our next year is Shoftim, and that's the opposite. In terms of the nations we encounter in the book, you have the Kanani tribes who live in the central area in Israel. You have the Hori who live further south. You have raiders from the east, Ammon, Moab, Amalek. And all of these people are identified in the Torah as being people who have sinned and created an immoral society. And God says, I'm taking you into the land, not because you're wonderful and I want to give you land, but because these people are so terrible that I need you to be my tool to eradicate that society. I gave you a brief outline on the sheet, if you see, right after source number 4, an outline of the events within the book. It begins with Yoshua taking over, a dialogue with God. Continues with first steps in the land. The spies that are sent to Jericho, who find out that everybody's afraid of the Jews, crossing the Jordan, becoming Israeli. I'm going to come back to that. Chapters 6 to 12 are the wars that we fight. That includes the story of Gibeon, who tricked us into making a treaty with them. We're not going to have time to discuss that right now. Chapters 13 to 21, the distribution of the land among the tribes, identification of cities of refuge, cities for the Levium. And then chapters 22 to 24, the end of the book, which includes the 2.5 tribes going home, crossing the Jordan, heading east, and the concerns that they had that they might be somehow discredited, viewed as no longer being part of the Jewish people because they're crossing the Jordan to live on the other side. Okay, that's just the introduction to the book, and I realize that it's whirlwind and there's a lot that we didn't cover in it, but that's the idea of a quick introduction to a book. What I want to do for the rest of our time is talk about this idea of transitioning from slaves to Israelis. That's, I think, something that's very important. What makes a national identity? What makes for the identity of a nation? Experiences together.
Common purpose.
Common purpose. Good.
Land.
Common land. Potentially. I mean, we managed for a long time with a vision of a common land. But yes. Sorry?
Language.
Culture. How do you define culture?
Shared values that are held in common.
So playing hockey doesn't count or does count? Is that, which side is that for a culture? Watching hockey. I think it's a really interesting question, particularly today. We live in this very xenophobic world, right, in which everyone wants to define, you know, what is our national identity. You know, and even in multicultural Canada, there's still this sense of sort of who we are and what defines us, right? You can't go to Indigo without seeing the big slogan on the bags, right? The world needs more Canada. What exactly does that mean? I'm not sure. But the question is, what exactly is a national identity? So take a look at source number 5, please. This is an article, How to Build a Nation, from the Harvard Gazette. But what I wanted was Francis Fukuyama, who's quoted in the article. He says the following, and one of his big fields is the issue of nationalism and social identity. He says, Francis Fukuyama, who in 1992 famously predicted the end of history because liberal democracies and free market economies suggested an end point in the evolution of government, said that external forces can erect the skeleton of state in an embattled country, creating police forces, administrative structures, taxing authorities. You can do what you want to create institutions that identify a nation as a nation. But nation building goes further and involves a shared sense of national identity, built on elements that tie people together, such as shared culture, language, and history, that cannot be imposed from without. So in other words, you can go to an Iraq, let's say, and declare, these are going to be your boundaries, and all of you are now one nation. But if you don't have shared culture, language, and history, it's not going to work. They're not going to see themselves as one nation, one people. And I saw a fascinating study that just came out earlier this year, by the Pew Group. What it takes to truly be one of us. They went country by country, polling people and asking the question, what does it take to view somebody as a member of your society? The results varied from country to country, of course, but they ended up with 4 primary factors. Language, sharing customs and traditions, which I would call culture, religious identity, which I think can be reflected as ideals, and birthplace, which I would view as history and origins. I would add one more element to their list. If you flip the page to source number 7, Professor Ernest Gellner in Thought and Change Nationalism is not the awakening of nations to self-consciousness. It invents nations where they do not exist. Gellner was of the belief, that a nation isn't a thing. Rather, we create a national identity when we are nationalist. If we view ourselves as part of a group, that's what creates the group. Now, leave aside his question of whether nations have their own unique identity. The point that I draw from here is you need a nationalist sense. People need to feel like they are part of the group. It isn't enough that we have a shared culture. It isn't enough that we speak the same language. It isn't enough that we were all born in the same place. If you don't feel like you're part of it, if you don't feel a certain pride in it, then it's not going to work. That's required as well. And I make these points because these are the questions we have to ask ourselves about how it is that the Jews actually become Israelis when they enter into the land. What is the national identity of the Jews who are slaves in Egypt? What's their national identity? Hebrews? Slaves. They're Jewish slaves living in Egypt. Right? That's really what they are. We do find the idea that they preserve their language. I brought you the classic Medrash in source number 8. How do we know they did not change their tongue? Their language remained the same when they were in Egypt? Quotes the pasuk from Yosef. Yosef says to his brothers, "For you see that my mouth speaks to you." Right? That's in the beginning. And then at the end, "And they said, the God of the Hebrews has appeared to us." Right? Okay, Avrim Nikra Aleinu, that's Moshe speaking. And then, one more pasuk to associate Ivri with the Jews, the refugee came by Palit, and he told Avram the Hebrew. The point is, as the Medrash is deducing, that Hebrew is an identification of our nation, and those who speak Hebrew are speaking our language, and the argument is that that's something that we preserved from the time of Yosef all the way through the period when we were in the Midbar, when we were in Egypt. So we preserved our language. But what about our culture? What's our culture when we're in Egypt? We're slaves. Right? Our life is dictated at that point by the Egyptians. That's who we are at that stage. Our ideals when we're in Egypt, what does the Medrash tell us? What are the ideals? Mostly idolatrous. Right? All the Midrashim that speak about the Jews descending to the 49th level of impurity are one example of it. But even when you look in the Chumash itself, look at the way they behave when Moshe comes to them, look at their position when they leave the land, and you can see within that they're not living what we would identify as a Jewish lifestyle. The culture is a slave culture. The ideals are Egyptian ideals. And what about our origins? Well, they're no longer as relevant. Meaning we have the shared origin, we're still the descendants of Abraham and Sarah. However, when offered the opportunity to leave and things get difficult, what did we say? Let's go back to Egypt. Right? We would have been better off in Egypt. The origins are there, but they're not as significant to the nation. That has to change. Right? You can't stay that way. You can't pick up this group of people who have slave ideals, slave culture, and neglect of their origins, transplant them to another land, and say, poof, now you're Jews. It doesn't work that way. Something has to happen. So that you have a transition period when the Jews are in the Midbar, when the Jews are in the wilderness. Their language is still Hebrew. But the culture changes. Because what are your activities when you're in the Midbar, when you're in the wilderness? What do you do? Sorry? Walking and traveling for part of the time. They didn't spend that much time in travel. You're learning, right? They're learning the Torah that Moshe brings to them. They're building a Mishkan, a tabernacle that they're going to then maintain for the service of God. They have your standard social interactions, right? Just between people. Right? Unfortunately, that leads Moshe to be sitting there in a Beit Din all day long, because that's what happens when you have standard social interactions between people. But the fact of the matter is that at this point, the Jews are learning how to be a society of their own. They're on their own. They don't have the Egyptians around. They don't have other nations to harass them and to dictate what they're going to do. They have limited daily responsibilities. They're developing a culture of their own. And their ideals are supposed to become those of the people of God. It doesn't entirely work. There are a lot of bumps in the road. But that's what's supposed to happen along the way. They're still hesitant. When we get into the land, you get to Yahushua's job. And Yahushua's job is to complete the task of making us into our own nation in terms of our culture, living a landed life as Jews, in terms of our ideals to become more fully committed to an identity as people of God, and our origins to see ourselves as Israeli. And now we get to the implementation. If you look at your sheet at 9, 10, and 11, I gave you there the page numbers for the art scroll Tanakh, which we have been able to borrow from Shari Shamayim. I'm grateful to them for making that available to us. Chapter 5 in Yahushua marks our development of our sense of origins. I'm going to do this very quickly because we're running out of time for it. But three things happen for us in Yahushua chapter 5. The first, Bris Milah, circumcision, right? The national circumcision. Hashem tells Yahushua, it's time to give the Jews a brit. The last time it happened was when we left Egypt and we needed to do it for the Karban Pesach. We haven't done it since fear of travel, the effect of travel on the babies, all the different reasons that are given for why we didn't do it since then. But fundamentally, there was no Bris Milah at that point. Now, we're able to do it. But think about what that means. The Bris Milah is so important. Tell me something. Can you think of a national Bris Milah that occurred in Sefer Bereishis? Shechem, right? The city of Shechem. And what was the result? They were vulnerable. You just came into your land. You have all these nations who are afraid of you and are hostile to you. And you do a national Bris Milah for every man under the age of 40? Are you out of your mind? Why did you just do that? And the answer is because this is their sense of identity. It's that important that they get this done. As they enter into the land, they're about to do a Karban Pesach. They have to do it right. And it's a statement of emunah. It's a statement of trust in God that God is going to take care of them. It's really a remarkable thing that they do this right off the bat. I'm going to come back to the Bris Milah because there's another element that we'll have to see. Second, they bring the Karban Pesach. Right? They bring the Karban Pesach. That's very important as well. And you see the Karban Pesach here is described as, if you're taking a look in chapter 5, sentences 9 to 10, Hashem says, Galosi escharpas mitzrayim me'alechem, I have rolled away the disgrace of Egypt from upon you. What is the disgrace of Egypt? It's their old Egyptian identity. It's their old Egyptian identity as slaves. The combination of the Bris Milah and the Karban Pesach removed that identity. Because where does Bris Milah come from?
Abraham.
Comes from Abraham. Comes from Abraham. We have roots. We have an origin. We didn't start out as slaves in Egypt. We started out as residents of this land. Right? Slaves in Egypt don't have a history. We have a history that goes back before that. We lived in this land before, and we had a mitzvah of Bris Milah, and we recapture that. That plus the Karban Pesach, where we mark our departure from Egypt, removes the shame of Egypt, and then the very next thing that happens in chapter 5, the man stops, or really we stop eating the man that we had stored up. That's a discussion in the Gemara. And now we are eating the produce of our own land. This is what gives us a sense of origin. This is what removes the shame of Egypt and starts to make us Israeli, but it doesn't stop there. Chapters 9 and 10 tell the story of the Jews and Givon. So I will come back to it a little bit now. The Givonim are people who are called the Chivi. They're a Chivi tribe. They come to the Jews and say, we want to make a covenant with you. We're not one of those groups that you weren't supposed to make a covenant with, right? Before the Jews cross the Jordan, the Talmud Yerushalmi tells us, they send a message into the land saying, this is your last chance. Either accept the 7 Noahide laws, or get out, or fight with us. Those are your choices. And no one says we're accepting the Noahide laws. That's not, no one adopts that. But these Chivi, they play a trick. They come and say, we're from far away. We're not one of those groups. We have old bread, we have torn clothing. You have nothing to fear from us. Make a covenant with us. And Yeshua goes along with it, makes the covenant with them, and then finds out they're actually their next door neighbors. And now he doesn't know what to do. What am I supposed to do with these people? And he worries about foreign relations. He worries about what people are going to say about the Jews if they break the deal that they've made. Granted that we were cheated, Yeshua says we are going to honor our agreement. We are honoring our word. It will be a desecration not to. And he develops a culture that looks at the Jews not just as people living in a land right now, but looks at what we represent when we deal with the outside world. How do people look at us? How do we look at ourselves? That's what Yeshua is doing. He is developing a culture. And then finally, developing ideals. In chapter 7, you get the story of reward and punishment. After the war with Jericho, after the war with Jericho, right? Yeshua had decreed no one should take from the spoils. The spoils should be left. Various reasons for that, and this man named Achan ben Carmi takes from the spoils from the war, and the Jews are punished for it. The Jews go to the Jews go to war against Ai, this very small city, and they are routed. And Hashem explains to Yeshua, that's the way it works. You are a nation now, and a nation stands as one, and a nation falls as one, based on your fulfillment of your commitment to God. And what we see here, taking these themes together, is that this is how we go from slaves to Israelis. We were a nation with our own language, but we didn't have a sense of our own culture, we didn't have a sense of our own ideals, we did not have the freedom to dictate what those would be, right? We had an awareness of our origins, but it was not strong. And along came this entry into the land under Yeshua, helped by the transition in the Midbar, in the wilderness. And we took those steps that would identify us as Jews, citizens of the land. The Bris Milah, hearkening back to the original Bris Milah of Abraham's time. The Korban Pesach. The ways we interacted with the nations around us, with Givon. The Amunah, I should have mentioned, the faith that we displayed with the Bris Milah, the collective reward and punishment, that's what converts us into being a nation of our own in our own land. Last point, in general, for the shiur that I'm going to be giving, I want to end each shiur by asking the question of, so how does this book help me connect to God? Tanakh is not just history of what happened. What does this mean for me today? And to me, thinking about the three facets of national and personal existence that I really highlighted, the culture, the ideals, and the origin, I think those are things we have to ask ourselves. Culturally, is my day-to-day life, not my mitzvos, which are, important, I'm not minimizing that, but my lifestyle, is that a Jewish lifestyle? My ideals or my beliefs, the ways that I dictate my behavior, are they anchored in my Jewish identity, my origins? Do I remember where I came from? These are lessons that I think are important to glean from Sefer Yehoshua. Thank you very much. And